Nothing's certain in politics, but professionals know one thing. Subscribing to the Cook Political Report is the right decision in every election cycle.
For more than four decades, the Cook Political Report has been providing political professionals with the right analysis to help them invest political capital with confidence.
A deep knowledge of the past, combined with a meticulous, unbiased analysis of the present, produces the most accurate predictions of the future, time and time again.
Because it's all backed by data from every input that decides elections for president, Congress, and governorships.
Subscribers to the Cook Political Report get the clarity they need through smart analysis that you won't get anywhere else.
Like the very latest outlook for every race and access to our analysts. Amy Walter, David Wasserman, Carrie Dan, Jessica Taylor, Aaron Covey, and Matthew Klein.
The Cook Political Report offers
the right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
For getting it right.
Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe.
Hello, welcome to The Odd Years. I'm Amy Walter. Californians often like to think of themselves as the center of the universe. After all, they've got Hollywood and all that sun and celebrities. But when it comes to politics, this deep blue state is rarely in the spotlight. Until now. The passage of Prop 50 in last Tuesday's election was the most consequential development to date in the redistricting wars. The new Democratic-drawn map will cost Republicans 3 to 5 seats in 2026 and also shores up 5 vulnerable Democratic incumbents. The win is also a feather in the cap of Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom, who hopes to ride the momentum from Prop 50's landslide win all the way to the White House. And then, just a few hours before we tape this show, Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi, the San Francisco icon who led House Democrats through multiple wars, economic crises, and impeachments, announced she would retire after nearly 4 decades in Congress. Her decision unleashes pent-up political floodgates and kicks off a fierce primary fight for the chance to fill that iconic district. To talk through all of this, I've invited my colleague, House editor Aaron Covey, who's covered the redistricting wars as closely as anyone in the country. And joining us is also Mark Baraback, an LA Times columnist and expert in all things political in California. We recorded this conversation on Thursday, November 6th. Mark Baraback, so great to see you. You're live in San Francisco. You're on the East Bay.
You know, when you leave the Bay Area, just tell people San Francisco, and then you can zoom in a little bit. But yes, I'm in the East Bay.
Okay. And Aaron Covey, you're here with us in Washington, D.C.
Well, Roslyn.
Oh, and in Roslyn, Virginia.
Across the
Boy,
river,
I am just really messing up. Maybe we could just edit this whole thing out. But I'm really excited to dig in to all that Prop 50 means or could mean going forward. But first, Mark, I feel like this is so fortuitous that we are recording this the day that Nancy Pelosi officially announced that she will be leaving Congress. She'll be retiring from her seat. No one has covered Nancy Pelosi for as long and as insightfully as Mark Z. Baraback. So first, talk about her legacy there, and then we'll get into the nitty-gritty of what happens in the race for her seat.
I covered her first race for Congress in 1987. I was a toddler at the time, but I did cover it. Look, I think let's set aside any partisanship to the extent we can, right? We're all adults here. I think she'll be remembered as one of the most important and significant speakers in the country's history, not just because she's a historic figure, first female speaker on the House, but because she was so very effective, hugely effective. You know, it's funny, going back to that campaign, Nancy Pelosi was not hardly known at all to San Francisco voters, but she was very, very well known inside the party. Big fundraiser. She had a political salon that was a must stop for really any politician passing through town. So her opponents, it was a very large field. There were 14 people running. The rap on Pelosi, they called her the party girl of the party. And obviously she showed them. I mean, I would argue she was the heart, the soul, the spine, the sinew that held the party together. Just to give one example, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, love it, hate it, it would not have passed but for Nancy Pelosi. I mean, the people who watch this kind of thing will remember Scott Brown had won the special Senate race in Massachusetts. Democrats were ready to throw in the towel, say, you know, it's not going to happen. Pelosi stood up to Obama and Harry Reid and everybody said, no, we're doing this. You know, love it or hate it, a lot of people call her the godmother, the mother, whatever, of the Affordable Care Act. It's just one example. She was a brilliant tactician. You know, there's this notion of Pelosi, particularly people who know her well. She was kind of this crazy, wild-eyed liberal. Personally, she was quite far left, yes. But she prided herself on what she called this cold-blooded reptilian nature, where she was smart, she was tactical. And, you know, the last thing I'd say to sum her up, I mean, I think the reason Republicans hated her so much is because she was so effective. She got so much done.
And they could not figure out how to use their frustration against her and the stereotype of her to bring down other Democrats, right? They had tried for, I feel like, every year she was in power, that the knock against any Democrat running was they were a Pelosi Democrat, right? That was a way to undermine a moderate candidate in a swing state. And she, number one, was fine with Democrats distancing themselves from her. And two, for all of the anger that partisan Republicans had with her and the Republican base had with her, it didn't really stick as much as they would have liked.
And she still is the boogeyman, even out of power.
No, she is. I mean, San Francisco, look, and I love San Francisco, has so many connotations. It reads, it telegraphs crazy, wacky, lefty, nutty, right? But Pelosi, and I will say, proud product of Oakland, California, big Raiders fan, Pelosi used to quote Al Davis, right? The famous former owner of the Raiders, just win, baby. That was her philosophy. Just win, baby. Do what you got to do to win. Again, you know, this is a bunch of insiders. You remember Heath Shuler? He was this North Carolina guy that recruited, was very, very far right for a Democrat. Pelosi recruited him. Her motto was just win, baby.
Right. So, Mark, what happens now? There will likely be, like that 1987 race, it feels like 256 candidates are going to want to run that seat. Has been coveted for a long time by a lot of polls. Her daughter is going to be talked about as potentially the front runner. I'm curious where you see things.
It's interesting. I'm doing this off the top of my head, but if I am not mistaken, that seat has been held by just three people in 60 years. Two of them were Phil Burton, who held it for forever and ever and ever. His widow, Sally Burton, who held it for a very short time, and then since 1987, Nancy Pelosi. So as you suggest, congressional seats in San Francisco do not come up often. My understanding, and folks will have to check, is my understanding is that Christine has decided that she's not going to run. I heard this secondhand. I have not spoken with her. Scott Wiener is in, and I'm going to have to apologize to the gentleman whose name I forget, who's off the top of my head, who's been running for a while, who's the former AOC chief of staff, has been in the race for a while, tech billionaire. He's been in the race for a while. I think you're right. I think a lot of people will look at it. I don't know if we'll get as many as 14 seats. I would call Scott Wiener the front runner, if for no other reason than the fact that a large portion of his current state Senate district overlaps. The district, you know, Christina Pelosi would have had a hard time. Let me tell you a story, which to me so encapsulates San Francisco politics. I was doing a column some years back, not a lot of years back, but you know, there's been talk for a while about when and if Nancy Pelosi would retire. And I was talking to one San Francisco activist who, I mean, like I said, Nancy Pelosi, I cannot emphasize enough how revered she is. Just truly beloved in San Francisco. But this consultant, this Democratic activist brought up the fact, but you know, that Burton machine, blah, 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 you know, and they put her in there and they installed her, right? So as much as people loved her, there was still that resentment at this idea that, you know, she was the anointed one. So, which is to say, San Francisco voters are unlike voters anywhere in California that I know of. They are super engaged. They are super political. And so I don't think Christine Pelosi, if she does run, again, my understanding she's not going to, but she did run, it's not going to be a slam dunk sort of thing. As beloved as Nancy Pelosi is, 30 plus years later, people were still resentful at what they called her quote unquote anointment.
Well, and the rumor is that she might back Connie Chan, right? The supervisor?
My understanding is there's no great love. She feels no great love for Scott Wiener. That's something else that's great about San Francisco politics. I mean, look, I've covered politics for a long time and, you know, 13 presidential campaigns on. There's nothing like San Francisco politics. I love San Francisco politics. It is just, it's like nothing you see on the West Coast. It's much more like a New York City or like Boston. You know, in California, and look, I love my home state, but, you know, California politics is kind of like, you know, I kind of liken it to radio waves. They're kind of out there all the time, but people only tune in a little bit, like around election time. You know, most people, you know, were skiing or snowboarding or going to the beach or whatever. People in San Francisco just thrive on politics. They love politics. And that's what makes it so fascinating and so personal. So not surprised to see Nancy Pelosi pass by Scott Wiener. I don't know who she will end up supporting. I think it'll help. But again, going back to that whole anointment thing, I don't think Nancy Pelosi is going to, you know, lay a hand on someone and say, you're the one.
That's a great, great point. Okay. She was, of course, very instrumental. This is going to be my pivot, you guys. She was also very instrumental in getting Prop 50 over the finish line. Something that, let's face it, when it was first raised, Mark, I'm going to start with you, and then I'm going to go to you, Aaron. When the idea of not just redrawing the lines, but putting this before voters on the ballot was raised, there was a lot of skepticism that this could work. It seems to me, Mark, that Nancy Pelosi was, once again, much like with the Affordable Care Act, instrumental in making sure that this thing made it, not just to the ballot, but to success. What turned this from something that could have been competitive, you know, asking people to overturn a popular redistricting process, in favor of something that they admitted they didn't really want to see happen, but voted for it anyway?
So the short answer is math. There are simply more Democrats than Republicans in California, and more Democratic leaners than Republicans in California. It became a partisan issue.
Yeah, but Democrats going in also, I heard from plenty of Democrats who said, I really don't love this idea. Why are we getting into this tit for tat? I thought we were better than that. We like our redistricting commission. We were on the front lines of reform. Let's not throw that all away because of Donald Trump.
Look, I will admit, I've been wrong. It doesn't happen often, but I'm kidding. I was one of those who was skeptical. I even said Newsom was blowing smoke, which I think he was in the beginning. This, you know, oh, well, we're going to do this, beating his chest, you know, made it sound as if he was going to make this happen unilaterally. He couldn't. He didn't. As you suggest, we have written into the California Constitution this nonpartisan commission that seemed very, very popular. So to his credit, Gavin Newsom, there was some talk about maybe unilaterally just doing it. He didn't. He took it to the vote of the people. And he ran a very effective and smart campaign. And what they did was they turned this from a wonky, arcane sort of line-drawing congressional thing into a simple stick it to Trump, which is what Californians very much want to do. I don't have to tell your listeners how unpopular President Trump here is. And the other thing they did that I thought was very, very smart was they put a couple provisos in there. One was, well, we won't do this unless Texas does it. Well, Texas did. And then they said, well, this is only temporary. We're gonna only do this and then it'll revert back to the commission. And I actually went out and talked to some folks. I did what we call in business a talker. Went out and talked to voters. And I did hear, as you suggest, a lot of resistance from folks. In fact, one woman who I quoted who was like, you know, I think it's a really bad idea. I don't think reapportionment should be done like this. I like the commission, but it's a temporary solution. And again, you just, you know, people, there's an impulse there. People so dislike, I'm talking about a lot of Democrats and Democratic leaders and a few Republicans, but there's such a strong, intense dislike of Donald Trump. And the fact is, people really haven't had any way to express that sentiment other than going out and marching, waving signs. Prop 50 was a way to register folks' discontent, and whatever their reservations, they were willing to do so. assuming it's temporary.
Yeah. And just to put sort of an exclamation on your point, Mark, I'm just looking at the exit polls about Prop 50. And when they asked, should congressional districts be drawn by the party in power or a nonpartisan commission? 92% of California voters said nonpartisan commission, and 63% of those people voted to overturn the nonpartisan commission. So yes, they do still like a nonpartisan commission, but they dislike Donald Trump more. So, Aaron, let's talk through what this is going to mean, and you and Mark can talk too, because I'm sure Mark is going to be traveling to a lot of these newly drawn congressional districts. You and I today were talking about the fact that what's remarkable, not just about the fact that voters in the state overwhelmingly could hold these two thoughts. I don't like the idea of politicians drawing lines, but I'm going to give them the power because I hate Trump. And also that politicians, who are normally incredibly selfish about their district lines, were willing, Democratic politicians, were willing to give up big chunks of their district in order to benefit the bigger picture, which is picking up more seats in the state and, you know, sticking it to Donald Trump.
Yeah, it really is remarkable. I mean, if you look at Northern California, Jared Huffman and Mike Thompson gave up large chunks of their districts just so Democrats can oust Kevin Kiley and Doug LaMalfa, and they will be able to. Those are two of the kind of automatic pickups, I would say, for Democrats. There's a third that's in Southern LA County as well that was kind of, basically they disappeared Ken Calvert's district in Riverside County and created a new district in LA County that is now safely Democratic. And so those are the three obvious pickups for Democrats. And then you have Daryl Issa's district transformed in San Diego into what was a safe Republican seat into a really Democratic leaning seat. We have it rated as a toss up because we don't know what Issa is going to do, but this is a seat that Harris would have won by about 3 points last year. And then finally, you have David Valadao in the Central Valley. Obviously, he has long been a top target for Democrats. He is now in an even tougher position. So that's the fifth seat. So this is really consequential in terms of what party might control the majority next year. And that's because Republicans have the power to redraw lines in a lot more states than Democrats do. And being able to offset some of these new maps in red states will be significant for Democrats.
Yeah.
It is pretty remarkable what Aaron pointed out. You know, members of Congress willing to give up big, big chunks. I mean,
yes.
Look, we all know members of Congress. They feel like, oh my God, if I win by like less than 80%, you know, they start getting nervous. I mean, that was a big deal. And I think, again, that was Nancy Pelosi behind the scenes, twisting arms, doing whatever, getting folks to do that. That was a big, big part of getting this thing over the line for Democrats.
Aaron, you've talked also, I mean, let's go and look at a couple of these districts, because I'm thinking in particular about the Central Valley, which, like so many other parts of the country in 2024 that have significant Latino population, shifted pretty significantly in Trump's favor, in Republicans' favor. Now, I guess my question to you is, given what we saw in the results on the election Tuesday, given what we're seeing in polling about opinions of Trump among Latino voters, how worried should Valadao be that those voters who showed up in 2024 for him or for Trump just aren't going to be there this time around?
Yeah, I mean, it should be a real concern for him. And I guess what's in tension here is that you have David Valadao, one of the 10 Republicans who voted to impeach Trump after January 6th, who has kind of long had a brand that is a little bit separate from the national party, more so than other House Republicans. And so he does have a history of running ahead of the top of the ticket previously, but he didn't have to do that last year because Trump won his district by several points as the Central Valley shifted hard to the right. And so I do think there's certainly a chance that we see reversion back to what it was more previously. I don't think we're going to get back to the place that the Central Valley was in like 2016, say. But I do think that we're not going to be in a scenario where a lot of those voters who voted for Trump will be necessarily as motivated to vote for Valadao next year. Now, at the same time, Valadao probably has more power to persuade Harris voters than about any other Republican in California. And so I do think that this is certainly going to be a very competitive race. We'll see who Republicans nominate, too. It's not clear on that side what will happen.
You mean who Democrats nominate?
Who Democrats nominate. There's a bit of a competitive primary there as well.
Well, and Democrats haven't always gotten the strongest candidates.
No.
There. A quick break, and we'll be back with Mark Baraback and Aaron Cuppy. If you want to stay up to date on redistricting news, and I know you do, check out our new interactive redistricting map. It highlights the latest developments in redistricting efforts across the country, and best of all, it's free. That's right, free. It's in front of the paywall. Go to cookpolitical.com/redistricting to check it out. To go just down the coast for me, because that will be obviously very highly competitive. And then there's the San Diego district, you said, with Darrell Issa has to decide what he's going to do. Talk to us about what Democrats would need to do to flip that seat, or Issa needs to do to be able to hold on to it, if indeed he decides to run there, or if he says, I'm going to go try to run in a safer seat.
Yeah, I mean, he has a tough decision to make. Basically, he has three options. He can run in this seat, which still includes a large portion of his old district, but also a lot of new territory that make it significantly bluer. He can run in the new 40th district, which includes about 15% of his old district, but then he would be running against Young Kim and Ken Calvert, who have all announced that they are running there. So that would be a member-on-member-on-member primary, which I think is maybe unprecedented. I haven't been able to figure this out.
I don't know if I've ever seen that. Yes.
Yeah. Certainly in recent history. Or he can retire, which, you know, is what he did in 2018 when it was clear that he was going to have a competitive race in his old seat there. And then, of course, he made a comeback in 2020 in a different district. But yeah, I think he is one of the wealthiest members of Congress. And if he wanted to, he could put up a serious fight in this seat. And Democrats have a very divided field here as well. So if Democrats don't nominate the strongest candidate, certainly I think he would have a real shot at holding it. But without him, this is a district that I think is probably going to favor Democrats, given the fact that, again, Harris won it by 3 points last year. Biden carried it by a larger margin. And, you know, this is the kind of seat that is more inclined to vote for a Democrat by a slight margin.
Yeah. And Mark, to your point, and I know you have written about this a lot, about the long-term effects of this redistricting, I don't know what we're going to call it, precedent. Talk to us about what you see that could come from this. I mean, just the first thing off the top of my head, just listening to Aaron talk about the races, you know, one of the things for those of us who cover races and for those of people who do believe that redistricting should encourage the drawing of districts that are more competitive, that don't lean just so heavily to one party or the other, you can argue that the Independent Commission in California did just that. California finally had competitive races that were interesting and that were representative. And not only, as Aaron pointed out, do Republicans lose seats in this scenario, but Democrats get shored up. So there are now just a handful of competitive seats left in a state with, we're at 53 congressional districts, right? Or 52.
Prop 50 was bad. And to be clear, I'm a columnist. I'm allowed to express opinions. I think it was bad. Kind of out there by my lonesome, at least among, I mean, I also think Trump is bad. Square those two thoughts. Look, California, as you suggest, we have a history of a very, very aggressive gerrymandering. I mentioned at the top Phil Burton. He was the master. He drew this one Picasso-esque district one time and called it My Contribution to Modern Art. But there's a statistic that I threw out there in the whole, I guess we call them the odds, but there was this whole decade where California had something like 500 congressional races, one seat traded hands in the entire decade. We did not have competition. The commission came along, all of a sudden California became a hotbed, 7, 8, 9, 10 competitive races. It worked. If, like me, you believe that the will of the people matters, if you think that politicians, instead of the other way around, this is bad. This is a race to the bottom. I'm of a mind, and again, this is an alternative history. We'll never know. I think that Gavin Newsom should not have escalated. I mean, look, Texas did this number. I'll say up front, terrible, bad, awful. Choose whatever negative adjective you want. It was a bad, bad, bad thing they did in Texas. They did it before. Had Gavin done nothing? Are we looking at maybe 5 seats in Texas? I don't know if it was necessary. We'll know in November of next year whether all these machinations matter or not. I think you and Amy, you and I are on the same page where we think that the economy and the state of the economy is going to be a lot more important determining the outcome. I just think it's a race to the bottom. And I think it's unfortunate that California dove into this race. And I ended my column by saying, fire with fire with fire. I said, the smell in the air is not victory, it's ashes. We're burning our political system down. When you have lawmakers like we have, and we'll have even more, perhaps next Congress, lawmakers whose greatest fear is not a Democrat, a Republican replacing them, but a more extreme member of their own party, they dig in, they become intransigent. What do you get? A government shutdown on what? It's 37th day now?
Yeah. And Aaron, talk about this idea that we've really opened a Pandora's box here, that this may never end. We're going to see these things every 2 years. States are going to say, oh, why not? Let's go put this together. Or do you think that we really have to wait to see the results of 2026 to see if legislators and other politicians want to keep doing this?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see a way for this to de-escalate, at least in the short term, unless one of the parties has a convincing enough majority in the House for it not to be as high stakes every 2 years. But yeah, I mean, I'll be interested to see if these other blue states that have instituted independent or bipartisan redistricting commissions in recent years go forward with entirely throwing them out. Like, I'm not sure if states like New York and Colorado, if there's going to be an appetite to just move back towards partisan redistricting for the near future. I know California, obviously, in its law, it will go back to the independent commission process. But I'm also curious, I mean, the independent commission obviously has a lot of latitude and can do something totally different with the map next decade. But I do wonder if, once you have all of these incumbents, a lot of Democratic incumbents who are now in safer positions than they used to be, if they're going to be under pressure, the commission, to also protect these guys who will have now had like 3 election cycles under their belts under this new, much more gerrymandered map.
I think that's a very, very good point. And it looks, Aaron, if we could just look at the sort of the big picture, look at the scoreboard right now where we are. How many states have moved forward? How many states do you think are still going to go forward? And what is the likely impact on the number of seats that one party or the other may be able to pick up through this?
Yeah, so I think big picture, most likely scenario, Republicans on net pick up 3 to maybe 7 seats due to redistricting alone. So that's not a huge number of seats, obviously. I think a best case scenario for Republicans is maybe they pick up like 10 seats. But at this point, I don't think we're going to see, Republicans can't pad their majority with 15 seats. And so we've seen new Republican drawn maps in places like Texas, Missouri, North Carolina. Now there's a chance that the Missouri map could get thrown out by a referendum. So we'll see what happens there. And then in Ohio, we saw Republicans basically made a deal with Democrats to draw a map that is slightly maybe more favorable for them, but it's actually pretty good for Democrats, given that Republicans were hoping to pick up a couple of seats in Ohio just through redistricting next year. And so those are the states that have gone forward with it. And then, of course, now Virginia is talking about throwing aside its own independents commissioned to draw a much more partisan map.
Yeah, thanks, yeah. Prop 50. You're coming to Virginia now.
I guess April, we'll see. Unfortunately, they didn't move as quickly as Californians, so it is the timing might be difficult, more difficult for them to pull off, because we do have to conduct elections and primaries at some point next summer. So we'll see what happens, and if Republicans can try to block that in some way from going forward. But you have Virginia, and then, of course, Maryland and Illinois. They're still talking about redrawing their maps, too. They already have gerrymandered maps, but Democrats could maybe pick up another seat in each state if they have new lines there. And then on the Republican side, we also have Indiana and Florida outstanding that I will mention that could go forward with new maps.
But Aaron, do you think what happened in California and then just the other results from Tuesday, you know, Democrats' big successes in New Jersey and Virginia, change the calculus in any way for whether one state or the other goes forward? Like if you're a Republican, if you're a Democrat, do you say, oh, we should stop this or we should keep our foot on the gas?
I mean, I kind of think, especially in Virginia, it only encourages Democrats to keep their foot on the gas because, one, I think you can feel more confident about a referendum passing next year. Obviously, Virginia is not as blue as California, but it is a state that Harris won by 16 points. Spanberger just won by 15 points. Excuse me, Harris won by 6 points. And so now I think if they put something on the ballot, particularly I think in a lower turnout special election, there's a very good chance that that would pass. And so I think if anything, it makes Democrats more aggressive in Virginia. You know, I don't know. I think some of these other states where it's just like one seat on the line, I think those are, you know, it's not always clear how much political will there is in these states to actually go forward with that because it's just a single seat.
Question, is that allowed? Is that okay? Can I ask you?
Yeah.
Okay. So I was talking to a Republican strategist yesterday, and I want to run this by you. I thought it was very interesting. He said that this might make some Republicans, that the results Tuesday might make some Republicans a little more hesitant to redistrict. His argument being they're going to look at some of these margins and say, it goes back to what you're saying about giving up some of your voters, and they might look at what happened at some of the margins, say, jeepers. You know, it would be one thing to go from 70, you know, from 80 to 70, but wow, look at what happened Tuesday. Maybe I don't want to go from like 65 to 55. So could this make Republicans in some of these states a little less hesitant to go forward?
Yeah, I think especially in states like Florida, where Republicans, some Republicans are talking about drawing themselves 3 or 4 extra seats there. I think that puts that a little bit more in jeopardy, and we might see a more conservative map. I mean, I think places like Texas, look, I mean, I don't think any of these Republican incumbents in Texas are still in real danger, except for maybe the one who is in South Texas, given the uncertainties about Latino voters. But I will say it puts in jeopardy their ability to flip 5 seats in Texas,
right,
as a result of their new map. I don't think it's going to be a dummy mander in the sense that you're going to see other Republican incumbents in vulnerable territory, because they did do a very good job of shoring up everyone and making sure all these folks are in like Trump 18 plus seats that even in a blue wave, I think would be difficult, very, very difficult for Democrats to flip. But yeah, I mean, I also think, you know, you can't be so short-sighted to just be thinking about 2026. Like, if you're creating some of these districts by making more Republicans more vulnerable or more Democrats more vulnerable in seats that, like, Harris would have won by maybe 12 points, that looks like fine for now. But, you know, if we're in a much more Republican environment, the tide could change.
Mark, I want to end it with here because the other person that is in the spotlight, thanks to Prop 50, is a guy named Gavin Newsom, the governor of the state of California. You may know of him. Just about every other question I get these days is about whether this is going to rocket Newsom to the top of the 2028 presidential betting. You know, that he's going to take this victory and it's going to make him the front runner for 2028. What say you?
Being the front runner at this stage of the campaign ain't all it's cracked up to be. Ask Gary Hart, ask Hillary Clinton, ask Edmund, well, you can't ask Edmund Muskie, but Edmund Muskie, if it was around, would tell you, you know, being the leader, at this point really doesn't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy political world. Look, I want to tip my cap. I have been critical of Gavin Newsom on many occasions. I will tip my hat to him. This was a triumph. It was an unadulterated triumph. Gutsy move, well-executed campaign. Does it make him any more likely to be the next Democratic nominee or the next president of the United States? No. Why? Look, I love California. I mean, it is. I have the tattoos from my shoulder to my calf. Right? These are Sierra wildflowers. If anyone cares, I love California. I am a love California human billboard. A lot of people don't love California. Many, many people do not love California who live outside California. They think California is crazy and lefty and wacky and tax happy and all this and all that. And if there's anyone who embodies that sentiment to a great degree, it is the, call him slick, call him well put together, governor of California, who telegraphs to a lot of people coastal elitism. I am skeptical. I have been wrong. I am among the many who downplayed Donald Trump. I will never, ever, well, the words can't, not, won't, never, ever are forever more stricken from my vocabulary. That said, will Democrats say, you know what? We need, the savior of our party should be a stylized lefty from San Francisco because it worked so well for us in 2024. I'm dubious. I think we're getting way, 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 way ahead of ourselves to anoint him front runner, much less the next nominee, much, much less the next president.
So what does he do now, Mark? I mean, do we assume that he does, after the victory laps, that he goes on sort of a national tour and becomes this, he now becomes the Trump slayer and...
You know, Gavin Newsom has been effectively running for president for the last year, right? He went to South Carolina to help, you know, campaign for all those competitive, oh, wait a minute, there aren't any competitive House seats in South Carolina, never mind. He went to South Carolina though, and he was campaigning in South Carolina, happens to be an important political state. You know, are we likely to see Gavin Newsom in New Hampshire? May not bother going to Iowa. I mean, I think it's a pretty good bet. But he's running for president. He has been running for president. He's going to run for president. I picture him sitting in his office in the Capitol, kind of like marking off the dates until we get to 2028. He's term limited. That was a very long answer, a very short question. Yes, you will be seeing a lot of Gavin Newsom over the next year.
Well,
or so.
That means that we get to see more of you, Mark. And that's the best. That is really what's important. If Gavin Newsom's in the news, then Mark Baerbeck's in the news. Mark, Aaron, thank you so much for joining us, walking us through all things California. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me on, Mamie.
Thanks, it was fun. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You're our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman.